It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, Medicare spends about $113 billion a year on kidney care. President Trump issued an executive order this month to change treatment of kidney disease. Will this federal initiative result in better care earlier for patients, or is it a cost savings move? Dr. Amit Tivar is the director of UPMC's Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Program. Welcome to the Confluence.
Kevin, thank you for having me here.
The president ordered HHS to develop policies to address three goals: reduce by 25% the number of patients developing kidney failure, have more Americans receive dialysis at home, and make more kidneys available for transplant. So let's start off with your overall reaction to this initiative.
I'll tell you, overall, we are very excited. We've never really had such an overwhelming national executive order to actually improve a system for a group of patients that badly needs better care.
So it's been long overdue?
Long overdue. And keep in mind, end-stage renal disease is something that is a multimodal disease that requires many different forms of treatment. So early on, you should have detection early, see a specialist. Later on, you might require dialysis, either at home or at a center. And then lastly, getting access to transplant. All three of those arms of the executive order need to be overhauled and is very, very welcome in the medical community.
The Trump plan includes five payment models to encourage doctors to treat patients earlier. So how would that earlier detection lead to earlier treatment and maybe overall be less expensive?
Yes. Yeah, so keep in mind that chronic kidney disease is a progressive disease. You don't wake up one morning with need for dialysis. You actually slowly have an increase in your kidney numbers, which means your kidneys are slowly failing to work. And at one point in time, you will go on to a point called end-stage renal disease, or CKD5, where you'll require dialysis. There's many times along the way that people should see a physician, may intervene with earlier care, and the most important option is to avoid dialysis altogether by getting a transplant before you require dialysis, which is an option very few of my patients actually take advantage of.
Mm. So is the key the earlier detection? So isn't there enough early screening for the early progression of the disease?
So you would think there is, but there's not enough. A lot of folks start with the early diagnosis and go right on to dialysis. And a majority of the transplants that we do at UPMC are done on people that are already on dialysis. Ideally, everyone should have their transplant done before they reach dialysis.
Hmm. Is one of the issues no financial incentive to do the early screening?
No. I think it's more awareness on the part of physicians and patients. And keep in mind, a lot of folks actually will not have any screening done, not see a physician, not follow up with an elevated creatinine. And kidney disease is very easy to track.
Is it hereditary at all?
Yes, there are many aspects of it that are, but it's not always something that will carry on 100% from generation to generation. So, for example, if you have a family history of diabetes and hypertension, if you have that yourself and have it uncontrolled, yes, you're at a higher risk of having kidney disease in the future.
So if you have it in your family, you might want to be proactive and ask your personal care physician, hey, check my kidney function?
Yes, and the kidney function is checked almost on every lab panel. So anytime you get labs done, the kidney function is almost always in there.
According to the National Kidney Foundation, more than 500,000 Americans receive dialysis treatment, most in hospital and clinic settings. The Trump proposal would encourage more patients to get dialysis at home. I understand there are two different dialysis treatments, hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. Could you briefly explain the difference?
So briefly, peritoneal dialysis, let me start with hemodialysis first. Hemodialysis is done by implanting a fistula or a port, and this can actually be used at a center, which does dialysis most commonly. They'll take the blood out of your body, they'll filter it through a machine and do the functions that a kidney does and put it back into your body. That session takes roughly 4 to 6 hours, has to be done 3 times a week, and people are pretty tired after that dialysis episode and generally have to rest and not work afterwards. The other option is peritoneal dialysis, where you have a catheter that's put inside of your belly. This dialysis can be done at home, by after appropriate training, after appropriate screening, and can be done at home by yourself.
So this is not like a visiting nurse, visiting
Correct.
Care provider coming to your home to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's
Correct.
A do-it-yourself?
It's a I would say do-it-yourself. It's a train to do-it-yourself. So people are trained. It's very, very easy to do. There's a machine that's put into your home. You do dialysis at nighttime, which means you start at bedtime. You do it for 12 hours. And in the morning, you unhook from the machine, and you have your entire day to do everything that you were doing before.
Is it less expensive?
It is.
So is this a matter of cost saving or efficiency, effectiveness, and maybe even convenience for the patient not having to go to the clinic, to the hospital?
So I think that it's an equivalent to hemodialysis, and there is some benefits to the patient. Because number one, you no longer require to be at a center. You can do things at home. And there are people that will be perfect candidates for peritoneal dialysis. There are people that are not going to be great candidates for peritoneal dialysis, and they should continue to use a home or actually a hemodialysis center. The people that are candidates for peritoneal dialysis definitely benefit from it. And again, Kevin, it comes back to the same thing over and over again. We need more awareness. You know, if you look at other areas of the world, other areas of the country even, there's much more use of peritoneal dialysis. And it's a matter of awareness and patient choice.
But as an expert, as a professional, are you concerned that patients could get it wrong at home, that it won't be as effective, and it's such a vital thing to keeping them alive, keeping their kidneys functioning?
So no, not at all. And I will say both the centers, we have excellent nephrologists, we have excellent dialysis teams, and these nurses work tirelessly to make sure that it's suitable for the patient, that it's a good option for the patient, and they're doing it well at home.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Dr. Amit Tivar, director of UPMC's Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Program. How might this executive order affect patient care specifically here in Pittsburgh?
Yeah. So one of the big sections of the executive order is increasing transplantation through two means. Number one, increasing more organs for availability and even promoting awareness and facilitating live donations for the donor. And as you know, Pittsburgh has a long history of transplantation. It's what I do for a living, and it's something that we would love to see. At the end of the day, if you look at all the treatment options for people that have end-stage renal disease, the best option by far, financially, for the patient, for the hospital, is transplantation.
So you would like to see transplantation before dialysis, Kevin, but is that the case now?
Kevin, I would like to see everyone transplanted before dialysis. It is not the case, and not by a minority of our patients are transplanted before dialysis.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I read that Medicare actually reimburses physicians, reimburses providers, I should say, more for dialysis than for kidney transplants. And so is it cost-effective for the kidney transplant if the donor kidneys are available?
So it's by far cost-effective because keep in mind, you're looking at paying for immunosuppression. People can go back to playing with their grandkids, going back to work, going on vacation, or being in a dialysis center three times a week for 6 hours, not being able to work and requiring that dialysis session that many times a week.
If more kidneys are available, mm-hmm. if this awareness campaign works, mm-hmm. does that mean expansion of your program?
Absolutely. We'd love to see it. Expansion of all programs. We'd like to see every single person on that list transplanted because we know without beyond a doubt that the best option for every patient is transplantation.
So along that progression mm-hmm. line, dialysis is pretty near the end stage?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So you want to get the transplant earlier. Does that make it more likely to be effective?
Yeah. So we also know that people that get their transplant before dialysis, especially with a live donor, do better. The grafts work better, longer, and faster.
We have just a couple minutes left.
Sure.
I want to ask you, the Trump administration was critical of some organ procurement organizations. What's the issue here? Is it just individual reporting and maybe the paperwork isn't?
I think there are OPOs, organ procurement organizations, that are very effective, that procure a lot of organs, that actually maximize transplantation in their area, and there are ones that don't. We've always dealt with a very long-standing OPO called CORE, which manages the western part of Pennsylvania and West Virginia. I've worked with them since the day I got to Pittsburgh. We are, CORE is an excellent OP organization. I think they maximize the number of organs that can be obtained. They worry more about getting patients transplants than they do their own numbers. And it's something that can be modeled throughout the country. So I think the Trump administration's plan is to have a better metric of how well organ procurement agencies do. And they, I think, want more of the organ procurement agencies to be like CORE, where they're very effective and very pro-transplantation and procuring organs for patients.
You said they maximize. Are organs, do you think, being wasted elsewhere?
So, yeah, no. I will say, being it coming from several different OPOs throughout my history, there are other organizations that would pass on organs that we would very likely use here and can benefit patients.
Final question is, whether it's 2, 3, 5 years, what realistically can you hope for from this initiative?
So I think the first and most important fact of this is we already have awareness. We already have people taking a note on this. It's been all over every single newspaper and, you know, CNN and Fox. Having that awareness that this is definitely a problem, that there are options that are already available, and what we can do to maximize those, that awareness already makes changes for us.
Dr. Amit Tivar is director of UPMC's Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Program. Thanks so much.
Kevin, thanks for having me on.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Pirates play their first game at Three Rivers Stadium in 1970. The Buccos took on the Cincinnati Reds, losing 2-3, but donning new uniforms. The city threw a parade before the first pitch, and it was the first time fans could drink beer in the stands since the early 1960s at the old Forbes Field. Three Rivers Stadium would eventually seat about 58,000 for baseball games. It would go on to be the home stadium for the first World Series game played at night in 1971. The Pirates won the series that year. It was also the site of the famous Immaculate Reception by Steelers fullback Franco Harris. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Retired Justice John Paul Stevens, whose Supreme Court opinions transformed many areas of American law during his 34-year tenure, died at age 99 yesterday with family nearby. His decision-making affected us all, and that legacy of kindness, humility, and wit touched none more than his colleagues on the bench. University of Pittsburgh Law School Dean Amy Wildermuth clerked for the late justice and remained close to him over the years. She joins us by phone now. Amy, welcome, and my condolences for your loss.
Thank you, Kevin. It's great to be here.
You worked with Justice Stevens from July of 2002 to July 2003. Tell us about that experience.
I did. I had the great fortune of being selected to work for Justice Stevens. And my selection is pretty much trademark typical Justice Stevens. He was the circuit justice and had deep roots in the Midwest and in Chicago in particular. And he often hired from that geographic region. Now, most justices don't necessarily take that approach, but Justice Stevens was true to his sort of Midwestern upbringing, and he thought that he should bring in folks from the Midwest in particular, and he gave us a chance to serve at the greatest place on earth for those of us who are lawyers, and that's the Supreme Court of the United States. And it was truly a transformational, life-changing moment for me.
There were, of course, many important decisions during that term that you clerked for Justice Stevens. You had an especially visceral reaction to one case in particular, Lawrence versus Texas. Remind us briefly about that case.
Of course, Lawrence was in this line of cases that led to the gay marriage decision, which, of course, took many, many years to get to. But Lawrence was the decision in which they overturned Bowers v. Hardwick, and that was the criminalization of sodomy. And so in Bowers, they had said that this was an okay thing to criminalize. And by the time we get to Lawrence, the court says we should no longer criminalize that conduct. And for me, that was especially important as the only out gay law clerk at the United States Supreme Court at that time.
So what was it like to hear that decision rendered? Justice Kennedy wrote, quote, they're entitled, the petitioners, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, are entitled to respect for their private lives, and that sex in all its adult consenting forms should be, quote, an integral part of human freedom. The state, Kennedy wrote, cannot demean their existence. What was it like to hear that in the nation's highest court?
Well, you know, once the opinion is delivered, we've already spent a long time working on it. So it was more a sigh of relief for those of us who had finally gotten it out the door, right? So that was a great moment. I still have pictures from that day with all my fellow law clerks. But what you will also recall from that opinion is that Justice Kennedy basically said we should have did what Justice Stevens told us to do in dissent in Bowers many, many years ago. And that was particularly meaningful.
Right. Michigan, affirmative action, that was in a very important case during your time of clerking.
It really was. That was the big test to the affirmative action programs at both the undergraduate level and the law school at the University of Michigan. And of course, at that time, the court upheld affirmative action in the law school case in terms of how it was being handled. Those are very close decisions, and as we know, those are under fire now. So we'll see how long they will, in fact, last. But it was a very big moment, of course, at the court during my year.
Of course, his legacy lives on, not just through decisions, but in former clerks, mm-hmm. colleagues like yourself, many also like you, now in charge of inspiring other young legal minds. What does it mean to you today and in the future to sort of carry that torch for the next generation of legal minds?
Well, it is certainly a great legacy that we have to live up to. And one of the most important things, especially in my role as dean at Pitt Law, I think a lot about the public servant aspect of being a lawyer, the one that Justice Stevens embodied, right? He was committed to being a public servant at every stage of his career. He modeled that for all of us. And he said, that's what's going to change this world.
And Amy, we're going to have to leave it. We're going to have to leave it right there. Amy Wildermuth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy is the dean of Pitt School of Law. She clerked with Justice John Paul Stevens. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One of the hardest parts after getting out of prison is finding a good-paying job. But some organizations in Homewood have made the neighborhood a proving ground for helping former inmates rebuild their lives. 90.5 WESA's Ann Lee Herring has this report from our series, Homewood Bound.
A periwinkle frog with geometric markings crouches in a sea of red, its toes splayed out as it prepares to leap. The painting now hangs in Dwayne Drummond's Homewood apartment. But he remembers when he found it in somebody else's trash.
And that's when I was at a bad period. So that was really just like, you know, like a frog bounces and he jumps back. So I was always put that in my mind, like that's the bounce back.
At the time, Drummond made deliveries for Amazon while also working at McDonald's. The hours were long and he had no benefits, but he had six children to support. And with a drug dealing record that included time behind bars, Drummond took the jobs he could get. Still, Drummond says he couldn't get ahead. But then he enrolled at the Trade Institute of Pittsburgh, located in an old Westinghouse facility in Homewood. He learned about the program from a friend.
And he's like, man, I make $22 an hour. I went to the Trade Institute.
The Trade Institute offers a free 10-week masonry course. Students scrape mortar and stack bricks on a vast shop floor. They build simple walls or more advanced structures. 80% of students have been incarcerated, but the Trade Institute helps them get hired in a range of fields, including manufacturing and carpentry. Nearly all graduates end up with jobs that pay at least $15 an hour. Trade Institute case manager Dante Green says the program is designed to meet the many challenges people with criminal records face, such as not having a driver's license or housing.
I think the cool thing about this place is that we meet everybody where they are, and just being able to, you know, pick apart different pieces of their life that needs to be put back together and come up with a strategy on how we put those things back together.
Green says perhaps most crucial, The Trade Institute mentors students so they can build healthy relationships, develop good work habits, and manage life struggles.
We can train anyone to make them employable, but to keep the job is what we're in the business of doing.
Nearly 400 students have completed the program over the last decade. The program is tough. One-third of those who enroll don't graduate. But among those who do, the Trade Institute says only 8% end up back behind bars. That's way lower than Pennsylvania's three-year recidivism rate, which has consistently been around 60%. Dwayne Drummond got a job as a window installer after completing his training in January. He still worked full-time at McDonald's and took shifts after classes ended. But now, Drummond says he has good pay and benefits. Plus, he says he feels motivated every day.
It may start out hard, but once we got the window in, we wipe it down, it's looking good. It's every day. Hey, I did that. Well, I need to work on that.
Drummond still works at McDonald's, but his ultimate goal is to start his own business. That was Dave Jenkins' dream, too, when he got out of prison about 15 years ago. But, like many who come out of incarceration, he had no credit history. And that made it hard to get a loan.
I'm a criminal. They weren't going to give me a loan. You know what I mean? I'm fresh out of jail. Hey, can I get some money to start a business? Nah, I don't think so.
But today, three massive barrel smokers stand outside what's now the Dream Barbecue. A cook tosses racks of ribs on the grill well before the lunch rush. Jenkins worked 2 years to save enough money to buy this storefront in Homewood and picked people's brains on how to run a business. 15 years later, he now employs five people, all of whom have been incarcerated.
That's all I hired because I understand what it's like. I've been there. For the most part, that's all they want is a chance.
Jenkins says he could get a loan from a bank today. But when he made some upgrades a few years ago, he borrowed from a financial institution called Bridgeway Capital. Bridgeway's Sean Thomas made that loan. He says his company invests in places like Homewood, which banks often view as too risky. And he says that support extends to people who have records.
We don't look at your past. We look at your future and what you're trying to do.
Bridgeway's funders include local foundations and churches. Thomas says he works with about 50 Homewood businesses, about a third of whose owners have done time. Thomas warns clients that starting a new business isn't easy. But standing outside the Dream Barbecue, he says clients who have spent time in prison are just as successful as clients who haven't.
When you look at the pressure that they were in beforehand, this is a little bit easier, I would say. You know, when you're incarcerated, it's day-to-day survival.
Ridgeway plans to open a business center in Homewood this fall. It will join another resource hub the University of Pittsburgh brought to the neighborhood last year. Homewood's Community Engagement Center is located on once-bustling Homewood Avenue. Security guard Rob Robinson is the first person most visitors see.
Hey, but what's up? How you doing today?
I'm good.
Robinson used to deal drugs, and he says old acquaintances are sometimes confused to see him as a greeter for the center.
I know so many people, and people, you know, still thinking in the back of their mind, like, what's up? How you doing? What you doing here? You know, I'm working, like, come on, now I'm working.
Robinson spent 10 years in prison, and his boss considers that an asset. Center Director Darren Ellerby says she didn't worry about Robinson's record because he'd made it through a vetting process. And when Ellerby was looking to fill Robinson's position, she told colleagues she wanted to find someone with a relatable story.
Someone that could say to a young man or a young woman in the center, I see what's going on. Please take advantage of what the center has to offer. You could go down the wrong path, and I don't want you to.
For his part, Robinson says some people with records might not feel comfortable visiting the center.
But I keep a smile on my face to let them know that I'm not downing them for what they do or how they might feel. I give them an opportunity, like, if I can do it, you can do it.
Ellerby says that kind of connection helps make the center and the support it provides feel like part of the neighborhood. Anlie Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
Tune in tomorrow for a look at where returning citizens find housing and whether they can find a place as Homewood rebuilds. You can find more on this series at wesa.fm/homewoodbound. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Things have quieted a bit at the state capitol after the legislature passed a budget last month for the new fiscal year. The House and Senate returned to full session in September. Joining us now to talk about some of the priorities when lawmakers do return is Senator Jay Costa of Allegheny County, the Democratic caucus leader. Senator, welcome back to the Confluence.
Well, great to be with you.
Overall, the budget process this year seemed to be a bit easier than it's been in some recent years. Why so?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. I think, first and foremost, the experience we went through in 2015 and 2016 with Governor Wolf's initial budget, you know, I think taught us a few lessons that we hurt a lot of folks, quite frankly, back then when we delayed the budget for more than 9 months. School districts and nonprofits, organizations that provide services were impacted significantly, and I think members recognize that we have to come together and compromise, and in a divided government, that's exactly what we've done the last couple of years. So they have been relatively modest budgets, and but they've been ones that we've been able to get done and highlight the priorities that both parties have recognized of importance.
How much did the higher-than-anticipated revenues help the process?
That helped a significant amount because I think at the end of the day, when we finished about a little over $800 million in the revenue surplus, most of that went back in to take care of what's called a supplemental budget to address unexpected costs associated with human service programs across Pennsylvania. So it allowed us to be able to do that. Otherwise, we'd have to fight and figure out how we were going to pay for that. So I think having that extra revenue was very, very important. And also, it also allowed us the opportunity to, you know, budget going forward in terms of the revenue side allowed us to be able to have additional spend. It limited the ability to, fight over limited resources coming in. So it helped us a great deal in that respect. And probably the most significant thing that came out of that was it allowed us to begin to restore our rainy day fund. We put in excess of $300 million into the rainy day fund, not knowing when the next time we will need to tap into that. So all in all, it was a good budget. And like I said, modest increases in education. We also made investments in human service programs and et cetera. So it was a good budget at the end of the day.
Are you disappointed that the governor did not veto the elimination of the cash assistance program, about $200 a month for some of the poorest of Pennsylvanians?
Well, we're certainly disappointed, but we know that that was a high priority for our Senate Republican and House Republican colleagues. For whatever reason, they were listing that as one of the top things they wanted to achieve was to prevent folks, these 11,000 individuals who are the most needy, quite frankly, in our society, individuals who are disabled, individuals who are dealing with addictions and the like, a modest temporary stipend to help them be able to pay for some of the things that otherwise the other programs are not able to help them pay for. So certainly disappointed. Now, we had worked with the governor's office, Senate Democrats, to add resources into a program called the FAIR program through what's called the PHFA, a Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency. We were able to add $15 million to that line item from 25 up to 40 in our budget negotiations. So at the end of the day, what we have now is $40 million that could be utilized through a housing program to be able to provide assistance as much as we can to the same population of individuals that we're talking about. So maybe in lieu of folks getting a $200 cash stipend, they would likely get assistance with respect to some housing and other types of programming around housing needs.
So housing assistance, but is there a way to revisit the issue overall in terms of the direct cash assistance?
Yes. So Senate Democrats, we've put together a proposal to sort of reinstitute the program, but certainly with some other types of modifications to it that I think to address some of the needs that people have heard. But we are working to try to reinstitute that in a legislative way, in the legislative process, and that's what we're working on right now. So that'll be one of the things that we would be trying to advance as we go forward in the fall.
Would that not have to wait to the next budget, though?
No, not necessarily. We can implement the program we can implement the program and given the governor the authority to be able to utilize his current resources to be as part of that. So it doesn't necessarily have to be in the general appropriations bill, but we can figure out a way to create a program and then give the governor discretion to use resources through DHS programs to be able to do that. And then next year we would just budget accordingly to be able to cover that if we're able to hold it.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is State Senator Jay Costa, the Democratic leader in the Senate. Once again, the governor called for increasing the minimum wage from the current $7.25 an hour, and it failed. You and many of your Democratic colleagues supported that increase.
Sure.
Why did it fail?
I think that we ran into a roadblock in what I'm told the House Republican caucus. I believe that the Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans had worked together to discuss together, I should say, to negotiate on a wage. The level of the raise, I think, was also part of the problem. I think folks felt that, you know, going from $7.25 to $12 may have been too big of a jump at one time. So we have talked about a variety of different things along those lines over a couple of years, but also looking at eliminating the statewide exemption with respect to that, which has been an important thing, which would allow local governments to be able to make a decision about what the minimum wage needs to be in their particular community. That was one of the things we talked about, and also the wage, what's called a tip wage. So there were really three components of our discussions as we went forward, but at the end of the day, we were not able to garner support over in the House that outright rejected any increase to the minimum wage.
Again, this was proposed when the governor unveiled his budget package. Is this something that you can revisit in the fall outside of the budget?
Oh, yeah, there's no question, and we're going to continue to pursue that. It could be done at any point in time. I mean, typically these policy initiatives are wrapped around the budget and largely for leverage reasons, but I think in this particular case, this is a high priority for us, but this is something that can very easily be done in the fall, and then we can advance it, you know, begin maybe January 1st or implement it April 1st or even, you know, July 1st of next year.
When we spoke on the Confluence prior to the January start of this legislative session, you said one of your priorities was passing a child sexual abuse bill regarding the elimination of the statute of limitations for future victims and establishing a 2-year window for victims whose time had expired to file suit. Are you pleased with progress toward that or not?
I would say I'm disappointed that we've not been able to advance the legislation to ensure that that would happen, that we would have this retroactive window for folks to be able to participate. But I would say that given that a number of the dioceses have put together programs that allow these individuals to be able to file a claim with the particular diocese or parish or whatever the case might be, that has developed and has sort of maybe taken some of the steam away along those lines of the urgency to get something done. I still believe that there's more work that needs to be done along those lines because there's individuals who are outside the scope of maybe particular a diocese or so that we need to also recognize as victims as well and give them the opportunity to be able to pursue something along those lines. So I'm pleased that some things are being done, but I think we need to have a clear and concise piece of legislation that says that these are your rights and these are the timeline that you have to be able to exercise them. And I think we still need to do that.
What other items do you see having a realistic chance of passing this fall when you return to full session?
We need to make investments in our communities. We're seeing the impact of the weather and the like here with our rain and our flooding and our landslides, but also our investments we need to make in our water and sewer. And certainly in the area of broadband, for example, there are many parts of rural Pennsylvania, not too far from Pittsburgh, that quite frankly still struggle to be able to get quality access to the rest of the world through the technology. So that's one thing I think you'll see happen. I think you're going to also see some conversation about election reform. There's a lot more we need to do in that space. We need to be able to figure out how we get same-day registration done, how we get no-excuse absentee balloting done. And finally, it's a local issue. Kevin, one of the things I'm going to continue to pursue is the whole UPMC Highmark, any willing provider legislation. I do think that while I'm pleased that we were able to push folks to make an agreement, as we now know, there's probably 300-some thousand folks who don't have the benefit of being able to, for example, if you're a Highmark customer, go to UPMC facilities and doctors. By having any willing provider provision legislation in place that we've been pursuing, might be able to resolve that in a more equitable way for everybody. So that's kind of one of the things I'm going to continue to pursue as we go forward.
Senator Jay Costa is the leader of the Democratic Caucus. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Kevin, thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You never saw his name on the ballot, but he was critically involved in thousands of individual elections, local, state, and federal. Mark Wolosik, who worked in the Allegheny County Elections Office for 48 years, 17 leading that office, died unexpectedly Sunday at age 65. Chris Potter, the editor of WESA's Government Accountability Team, knew Mark Wolosik well, and he joins us now. Chris, a great deal of respect for this guy.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm glad we're doing this because, you know, so often we think of public, you know, employees as sort of shiftless, lazy time farmers. And especially in these very partisan times, there's a tendency to look at election officials as somehow suspect. You know, they're throwing elections. Mark Wolosik's career started as a guy who schlepped those big old lever voting machines around. 40, 50 years later, his entire career really speaks against that as proof of a public servant who really did his level best.
Is it fair to say if you asked a Republican, you asked a Democrat, you asked a Libertarian, that they would all say he was not partisan?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, it's not just fair to say that. I had people say that to me when I sort of reported that he had passed away. I heard from people in both parties. You know, there were definitely people who have criticized various things. You know, the electronic machines used by the elections office, that wasn't his choice. That was a matter of federal law. But, you know, you can point to cases where he took that office and they did more rigorous checking of those machines really than any place else in the Commonwealth. And on the conservative side, too, there were a lot of plaudits for how they kind of updated their voter database, which is a way of sort of keeping down fraud and confusion on election day.
Can you give us a sense of just how big of an operation it is to prepare for an election, whether it's municipal contests or all the way up to a presidential election year?
Yeah, I mean, start with the fact that there are 1,300 voting places in Allegheny County. We have 130 municipalities. They're very divided. Almost every one of those polling places has multiple machines. There are thousands of machines, provisional ballots, absentee ballots, all of that kind of stuff. And of course, any mistake you make can become the subject of front page stories or whatever. So the fact that there's been so little controversy, the fact that so few people know the name of Mark Wolosik, I think shows what a good job he did.
You interviewed Mark Wolosik for the Confluence last fall when he retired. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Looking ahead, if you could change something about the way elections were conducted here in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, what would that be? And what do you think kind of the biggest hurdle elections officials are facing going forward?
I mean, I really think that, you know, the idea of voting in person is it's starting to become unworkable because you cannot find people that want to devote the time to do this. We're really grateful to people that do it. This is not a criticism of anybody. People say, wait a minute, that's like a 15-hour day. I can't devote 15 hours to do this. I'd love to do it. People just do not have the time to do it anymore.
And, are you going to do it? You're retired now. Are you going
to? No, after 50 years, I've gone through enough elections.
Chris, any particular personal remembrance you'd like to share?
I mean, that quote you just heard kind of sums that guy up, sort of a sort of playful sense of humor. And later from that interview, and I think this sums it up kind of, you know, he was talking about how he himself had been checked. His ID had been checked when he had gone to vote by some of the people that he dealt with as the manager of police. And he loved that story. And that was the thing about him. He's just had this great self-effacing quality to him. Pittsburgh born and raised guy, had that great work ethic and never got ahead of himself, never got above himself. And that's the part I think I'll always just respect.
From my interactions with Mark, he didn't seem like one to seek the spotlight,
yeah.
Especially on election night. Is that accurate?
Oh, it's very accurate, yeah.
But the spotlight found him during a special election night, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. This was, everybody remembers the Connor Lamb, Rick Saccone special election, which went to the very small hours. And I and many reporters were at the Connor Lamb event. And there was Mark Wolosik on CNN talking about the voting procedures and the procedures for counting absentee ballots. It was his biggest star turn. And it was excruciating for him. I think the only time he ever really got mad at me was I teased him about it a couple days later. I was like, hey, didn't I see you on CNN? And he just got, oh, you're not going to give me stuff about that, are you? You know, it was just not his way. And again, the way you do that job is by staying out of the limelight, because you never want to call attention to yourself, because if you had, it's usually because something went wrong. And so often nothing did. And again, the fact that we don't know his name a lot, even though we relied on him for so much for so many years, is the testament to the skill and to the integrity that he brought to that job.
And it's a sad day for Allegheny County elections.
It is, and it's a sad day for all of us who used to work with him. I saw him the last time at Allegheny County Elections Court this past spring, and he didn't even have to be there. He was just checking up on his guys.
Mark Wolosik is survived by his wife, Cheryl, stepson, Justin, and a step-grandson. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government Accountability Team. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy released a multi-year plan this week to spend more than $50 million on maintaining, rehabbing, and operating Pittsburgh's 165 parks. but the plan is contingent on a trust fund and voters okaying a tax increase on themselves. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.